Through my years of writing about contemporary art of Montana, the same names appeared over and again as mentors, teachers, and rule breakers. Frances Senska, Jesse Wilbur, Bill Stockton, Isabel Johnson, Jenny DeWeese and Robert DeWeese, and Helen McCausland. I came to see these artists not only as the first generation of Montana's avant-garde, but as the first group of people to question the themes and styles of the past and to embrace the uncomfortable newness of what it meant to live in a post-war world. This evening, I invite you to examine with me the works of two of these artists, Bill Stockton and Jenny DeWeese, especially in regard to the way they explored place. Let me take a moment to explain to you what I mean by place. As anyone who has ever stood in the shadow of a mountain or faced an exposed windswept prairie, the land has a way of embedding itself into you. It crackles your sun-dried skin and pulls like old muddy boots at the pasture-flooded dreams. The power of place not only speaks to the present, but to the past and to the future. Place conjures and it chides. For artists, place can act as an inspiration or as a constriction. Montana's landscape offers opportunity as well as isolation. Here, the reference to place is not meant in a purely regional sense, nor is it meant in a unifying nationalistic way. But instead, this kind of locus speaks to time, space, and as Edward S. Casey states, the formidable presence of place in our lives. He goes on to posit that people are distinguished by place. You are in them not as a puppet stuffed in a box, which would be a strictly container view of place, but as living in them, indeed through them. To be somewhere is to be in place and there to be subject to its power and to be part of its action, acting on its sense. According to geographer Yi Fu Tuan, a place is knowable through daily experiences over time. The feel of a place is registered in one's muscles and bones. Knowing a place clearly takes time. It is a subconscious kind of knowing. This idea of daily experiences adds to the emotional and cultural landscape of Montana during the time of the original avant-garde. For Bill Stockton, rooted in the tangled gullies and stretching hills of central Montana, place drenches his work. Imbued with fragility and stamina, his work speaks to the impending threats of winter and the anticipated orchestra of spring. Stockton's home, a sheep ranch in Grass Range, Montana, marked his physical place on the land, but his art reveals his own experience, reflecting the power of place. Jenny DeWeese came to Montana in 1949 when her husband Bob got the call for an art professor at Montana State College. She was born in Indianapolis, the youngest of four girls, and went to Ohio State University, then Michigan, and finally to Iowa and Montana. Her sense of place came gradually, once settled outside of Bozeman in Cottonwood Canyon. The result became a deep-seated, intimate relationship with the land in which she lived. She came to the landscape through the non-objective practice of line, form, and composition, looking for the push and pull of colors. As she once said of her landscapes, you can turn them upside down and it would be a non-objective painting, and it would work. Jenny Deweese once said of the Montana landscape, "Everywhere you look, there's a painting." Deweese and Stockton, friends and colleagues, shared a sense of place as resource and inspiration, as the daily experience of walking outside in unlimited beauty and bitter chores. Both garnered the Montana Governor's Award for the Arts. Both had a tendency to speak their minds. And both shared a love for livestock oil markers. Jenny said it was like using big tubes of lipstick. And Bill said he liked them because he could use them in his truck. From the color-drenched hillside of Deweese's views of her canyon to Stockton's patterned impressions of his surroundings, art enabled them to visualize the power of place. Their voices, not easily quieted, spoke in terms of the formal aspects of painting, which reflected their training. Both experimented with their own strand of modernism through a familiar relationship with the land and abstract portrayals of nature to which they gave concrete expression. Bill Stockton was born in 1921, and by 1935, his mother had procured a ranch in Grass Range. There, Stockton spent his adolescence and teen years trying to evade going to school by skinning skunks in the morning. He'd said, "I knew young boys smelled bad naturally, but add to that the smell of a skunk, and the teacher wouldn't allow you in the classroom." I used this technique of skipping school several times. I had that figured out. He joined the Army when World War II broke out and found art by sketching passengers on troop trains. 2 years later, in 1944, Stockton was transferred to a hospital unit outside of Paris. He was supposed to be in a refrigeration repair unit, but since no one showed up to teach the unit anything about refrigeration, let alone repairs, he ended up as a sign painter. In a 1999 artist statement accompanying a traveling exhibit, he wrote, "It was the sign painter who taught me the right use of brushes and how to apply paint. I use that knowledge to this very day." After the war, he took his French bride, Elvia, and his one-year-old son, Gilles, to Billings, Montana, where he worked as a sign painter. In 1947, he enrolled in the Minneapolis School of Art on the GI Bill, and the next year went back to Paris to attend the École de la Grande Chaumière. In that same statement, he added, "It would be a few years later that I would see the Jackson Pollock paintings for their worth. He was composing patterns instead of objects." During the 1950s, Stockton remembered this epiphany about Pollock while looking around his ranch. He noticed the intimate details of ranch life and said, "It made me see things on that hillside out there that never dawned on me before. Why the hell do I need to paint a panoramic? I started looking at the textures, the patterns, the tones. I started to paint that hillside, rearrange it, and compose it, and put it in different rhythms." In the way of someone who knows every step of his property, every acre, and every ewe, he stopped trying to relate the pictorial scene onto the canvas and instead relayed what he experienced, something he called the uncommonness of life. As he wrote in the preface of his book, "Today I baled some hay to feed the sheep the coyotes eat." Quote, "The snow is a foot deep, the wind continues to blow, and the sheep have given no sign that the weather will break soon. The storm is not usual or unusual for April. It, like death, is part of the sheep business." It was with Pollock's philosophy to portray the patterns of his daily life, not the objects, that enabled Stockton's work to evolve and embrace the abstractness of nature. As in snow formation, the angles of driving snow appear like a battleground, with flying, jagged swipes of color appearing across the piece. A near monochrome background spans the painting without a clue to the horizon line, the foreground, or the background. Like a ground blizzard, snow formation steals the certitude of safety, of sure-footedness. Wild brushstrokes slash black, gray, and white, while the dark underpainting speaks to the below-cold drifts, oblivious of any life it may smother. Grass Range sits in the middle of Montana with a current headcount of 110 people and a population in steady decline since 1920. For Stockton, that meant few neighbors and even fewer artists to share his ideas and his work. He notes in his artist statement from 1999 that his wife, Elvia, knows more about art than even sometimes I could believe. But that said, not only was there the isolation of a small community, but an isolation of culture, which may have added to the honest bareness of his work. Living through a harsh winter brought an added joy to a new season, as can be seen in his abstracted expressionist painting, Start of Spring. In this piece, Stockton's pure elation at the first nibs of grass, the swirl of a meadowlark's call to spring, and the complication of longer days, which meant more chores, all fight for space on the canvas. Throughout, sounds of the season permeate the piece. By depicting the individual forms, Stockton conveys the feeling of the soft earth thawing through a tough frost. He said, "I've always been fascinated by the ugliness of it, the hardness of it. That's me. I'm not dainty. I suppose my lifestyle had something to do with my temperament and my mental processes. Why would I consider a bunch of dead Russian thistle in a coulee beautiful? I don't know why. It just says something to me." This reflects the way Stockton internalized his place in the world, not just in his backyard. The seclusion he felt comes through in the starkness of a limited palette and the frenzied motion of his brushstrokes. In 1958, Stockton's work was accepted into three important national shows, including Art USA in New York, and two annuals in Denver and in Spokane. After that experience, he grew weary of the art world and decided to stick to Montana, where he hoped that his belief in his work would be accepted and understood as part of the language of the landscape. Stockton's wallpaper series reveals a sense of interior place. They speak to the role of memory in creating those formidable markers that resonate within the artist throughout his work. One such piece from his wallpaper series, Faded Roses, consists of the repeating pattern of ghosted flowers disappearing petal by petal into the yellow and uneven background. Although the pattern gives the viewer an impression that each repeated rose appears identical, the maker's hand clearly stands out. As, like so many days gone by, differences gradually dissipate. Deviations from each rose denotes not only a wistful regret, but the countdown of the calendar. Included in this piece is Stockton's own bent figure with a downward glance as seen from behind. His white hair and aging face, delicately defined, echo the self-portraits of Rembrandt. He includes himself in this piece because the wallpaper reflects his own memory of growing up in small houses, in small towns, where the bare cobbled walls offered little distraction from the hard farm life of central Montana. Stockton explained it as, in an attempt to bring some art into our crummy little house, my mother would look in Sears and Roebuck and buy some wallpaper. And then they'd try to paste it. It came with instructions, but you really needed a professional. They made a hell of a mess. And those damn things, roses or some kind of flower, things never matched. They never got it quite right. They even show up sometimes in an abandoned old farmhouse, and you still see the wallpaper stuck to it. Nowadays, some artists might think of it as art, but it's really an anti-art. That's my memory of wallpaper. It's a repeat design. It slid here, and it slid there. And even Cézanne would drop one end of a tabletop to give it motion, and they did that. And they created something. And that's my interest in wallpaper. For Stockton, the wallpaper represented a way to think about home and hearth. As an avenue to access the individual struggle for beauty under even the most dire of circumstances. There is a certain strength in the recollection of a place when that place cradles hard memories. It's a time Stockton called the Dirty 30s because of the hard winters, the dry summers, and the death of his sister. These impactful and formative years laid down a foundation from which Stockton based a majority of his work and the reason that he never, ever painted a clear blue sky. He said, I don't like blue skies. I go back to the Great Depression. The blue sky and the hot sun and the grasshoppers ate everything. Even the worms came in and they ate everything. And then the Mormon crickets came in and they ate everything. Because of the hot sun, we couldn't raise any crops and put the depression on top of that. All of it combined, I blame it on the blue sky. Working in oil, watercolors, tempera, and cattle markers, Stockton's interest in the surface and texture, no matter the medium, beautifully complicates his pieces. Looking at each aspect of his ranch, from the coulees to the hillsides, from the sheep he tended to the interior of his home, he never forgot the formal aspects of his art. For him, it was about creating tension through, as abstract expressionist painter Hans Hofmann taught, a push and pull of color. Stockton explained it as opposing directions. It takes your eye one way and then the other. Talking about the way he thought of composition, I got very fascinated with the scrub brush more than the rocks. What I had to learn in painting was how to create a surface. In Dusk, his surface confronts the viewer with a thick and wild demeanor. Color fairly dances with the drawing down of light. Blues, greens, and yellows each churn and shove as a single line across the top of the painting implies the horizon dipping toward evening. His use of graphite pencil enables him to detail the brush amongst abstracted shadows of deep blue and black. The forms interact with a singularity of purpose that allows the viewer to participate with the painting. The isolation of his life lived in grass range comes across as the essence of his work, the tone of his paintings and the compositions he envisioned. He noted that because he lived in that terrain, walked out his door to a horizon of hillsides and bushes, a few pine trees on a hill, snowstorms, and the bitter dry weather of August, each day became a fascination to him. These forms, I was born and raised in these forms, and thank God Jackson Pollock came along and exposed them to me. It took him a long time to understand that this was art, his sense of place, and he couldn't help but paint it. In Stockton's village in winter, the isolation contributes to the tension in the painting. Concentrating on a few windswept trees with hardly a leaf between them. Titled Village in Winter, there is no depiction of a village as typically defined. Shown instead are a grouping of rocks, a swell of ground, a few buildings that capture the center of the canvas. The bluish sky blends almost completely with the ash-like rendering of the snow-covered land. Churning brushstrokes conjure frigid temperatures. This painting speaks to Stockton's own experiential language as told through the landscape as well as location. The bareness of the Montana prairie caught in the enveloping weather. Stockton's close relationship with chores comes through in an unfiltered, unromanticized fulfillment of expectations. Bill Stockton's notion of place became a part of Montana's artistic history. He is noted as saying, "I can get interested in anything, welded sculpture, handmade felt, old photographs, stuff pasted to an abandoned farmhouse, and realistic portraits of my neighbors. But my main interest has been and always will be the harsh, abstract, semi-wilderness qualities of central Montana." Why? Because I was born and raised here, I guess. When Stockton's isolation became too much, he wandered down to Billings to visit with fellow painter Isabel Johnson or took a drive to Bozeman to see the Deweses. Josh DeWeese remembered a time when there was a bang on the door of his mother's house, and in walked Stockton unexpectedly with an array of new work, anxious to get Jenny's feedback. Jenny DeWeese went to art school, taught at all levels of education, and always made sure, even with having raised 5 children, that she carved out her own time in the studio. She nurtured her children as she nurtured all the artists in Montana, but especially the women. For Jenny DeWeese, a woman's place was in the studio and in the gallery and at the parties. She came to art at a time when women were scarcely heard. Museums and galleries routinely dismissed female artists. For DeWeese, it became vital to break the glass frame, so to speak. In 1989, she curated a traveling show, Women's Work, consisting of women artists from Montana. In 1995, she served on a panel for the National Museum of Women's Art. DeWeese showed extensively in the Northwest, but just as importantly for her, she championed young artists whenever and however she could. And the art community she was instrumental in forming not only sustained her, but it became her legacy. So for DeWeese, place took on the idea of landscape, of course, but it also encompassed her place in those times and in a way embodied the idea that the personal was political. To really understand DeWeese and the significance of place within her body of work, we first need to visit her early non-objective paintings. DeWeese's early work concentrated on what was then called non-objective work. Non-objective art defines a type of abstract art that is usually, but not always, geometric. It aims to convey a sense of simplicity and purity inspired by Plato, who believed that geometry was the highest form of beauty. The father of abstract art, Wassily Kandinsky, believed that music could be interpreted visually. DeWeese said when she read Kandinsky and his idea that art didn't have to be of something, but could transmit a feeling or a mood or a response of some kind, it remained with her throughout her life. Also in the mix were the influences of abstract expressionist Hans Hofmann, as well as the teachings of Hoyt Sherman. Hoyt Sherman's Flash Lab at Ohio State University combined the idea of using the flat surface to convey dimensionality without resorting to shadows, lighting, or traditional perspective. Hans Hofmann's theory of push and pull, which also influenced Stockton, used color and tension within the painting to convey perspective. Here, Dewey speaks to both of these aesthetic philosophies by incorporating geometric forms and floral-like biomorphic images. Delicate lines stand out from the squared-up reds and oranges, while the yellow pushes the image to the forefront, the darker reds recede. This painting is one of a series inspired by Karl Off's 1936 Carmina Burana epic choral composition. The spectacular opus by Orff becomes the perfect vehicle for Deweese's interpretation of Kandinsky's theory of visual music. The brush strokes, as well as the colors, create movement. The black underpainting comes through, pulling the eye around the canvas. Deweese reveals the character of the paint with a sweeping irregularity that enables the spaces to move back and forth, in and out. This painting also conveys a sense of intimacy, like the whispering of a chorus. There is also a hint of chaos and a dialogue coming through between lusting angels and spiritual demons, creating a kind of transcendent tension. Bare Trees continues the geometric aesthetic, bridging Deweese's non-objective work with her physical surroundings. In this painting, Deweese integrates Hoyt Sherman's idea of perpetual unity, as he taught in his Flash Lab, where he created a center of focus and trained his students not to draw, although drawing happened during the entire exercise, but in how to see. He said he was training his students in seeing the whole at a glance and in drawing bold, broad patterns delineating the whole field. In Bare Trees, it seems Deweese put herself back in Sherman's Flash Lab. The broad patterns play the lead in the piece. Fundamentally, the elements of the line span across the canvas. Using Hofmann's push-pull in regard to color, her palette reveals a space between the lines of the trees, while the steady tones of the foreground become foundational. Of course, the linen blue and violet of sky fit like puzzle pieces across the top of the painting. However, as Deweese noted of her landscapes, you could turn it upside down and it would be a non-objective painting. In a documentary made in 2000, Deweese said, "I think the non-objective painting had a very, very strong influence on me, so that when I work now, I'm almost as close to that as I am to painting what I see out there. But I do still paint what I see." When she says she paints what she sees, she doesn't paint plein air. She doesn't try to capture the light of the moment or the lingering late summer afternoon shadows. First, she sketched. And then she sketched. And after each sketch, she remembered what she called the essentials, the parts she believed were important to what she wanted to say. It is this idea of getting the essentials that speaks to her painting philosophy. When she painted objects, they were the essential part of the objects. What she needed, the line, the form, the color, the texture. Details faded, and the final painting resonated with her voice. In Winter Willow Grove, the all-over pattern, like a maze, carries the viewer from edge to edge. The influence of her non-objective work is clear here. The abstracted forms come together to bring the viewer to a conversation about place, about time, and about confluence. Her graceful lines intersect, snaking branches mingle. Like a spellbound garden, the entangled limbs seem to entwine as we watch. The present dances with the past, and winter's weight accumulates. Nearly monochromatic, the sides darken in shadows as the center illuminates as if lit from within. In this piece, a cross between landscape and non-objective painting, she examines perspective as the viewer travels through the trees, between the branches, and maps the unseen undergrowth. This image speaks to a continual sense of place, one considered and explored, yet forbidding and infinite. It is a wandering piece, a painting that speaks to time as place. Beginning in the 1970s, Deweese's work on the Montana landscape deepened. Later, when she began to paint on extremely large scrolled canvases, incorporating lush, salacious colors, she fully embraced the genre. Here, she seems to portray a bit of playfulness, with the lone leaf-like pine trees amid a flood of yellow clover. The trees bring to mind children in a field, each casting a shadow uniquely their own. The clouds overhead keep watch as a mustache of forestry lines the horizon. This is the level of interior space extending beyond the threshold of the home and into the wild open outdoors. It speaks of freedom and responsibility, of nurture and of nature, of play and of work, combined beautifully in a single scene. Deweese said of her transition to scrolls, "Because I tend to work on as large a scale as my space allows, I became intrigued with the idea of doing scrolls rather than framed paintings, both from a practical standpoint, of ease of storage, but more importantly, to introduce the Japanese tradition of changing displays according to seasons, moods, or whims. It allows more personal contact and decisions from the observer." Like all modernist artists, Deweese did not try to create the illusion of real-time space. Instead, through the use of sumptuous color, texture, and especially with her scrolls, the mere size of them, she got to the truth of the work by opening up space through her attention to line, shape, and composition, which in turn convey distance, scale, and structure. In this piece, the sky envelops the viewer and somehow evokes both sunshine and evening. In the same way the promise of spring pulls you into a sense of hope, Deweese pulled us into a sense of calm and assurance. In her painting, Springtime in the Rockies, Deweese's colors repeatedly range from the natural to the exceptional. She used cattle markers to express the Montana nature of her work, giving it a soft edge. This was the view from her studio in Cottonwood Canyon, showing evidence of the verdant undergrowth saturated in deep blue shadows, the stretch of willows and aspen reaching for spring. Again, it was the experience, the location, and the personal that delineated her work. Curator and artist Terry Carson once noted, "Her paintings are not tentative, cool observations of a detached person looking at the landscape from a distance, nor are they renderings of personal sentiment. These are paintings of a person knee-deep in mud, thorn, and thicket. These are paintings of a person who loves the land, who perceives a oneness with it, and expresses her sense of place with lusty grit. In Clear Cut, Deweese's voice deepens with the patterned stumps set against a dreary, cloud-darkened horizon. The complete devastation depicted here speaks to her non-objective style in a way that substantiates the overtones of the piece. The distance instilled by the pattern feels almost cautionary, like protective armor. Deweese portrays a place invaded, a place no longer with purpose. And if we think about the land as Mother Nature, the expanse of defilement rings with the voices of women, of betrayal, and of loss. In 1990, at the completion of Clear Cut, Deweese had finished curating the show Women's Work that traveled around Montana from 1989 to 1991. The purpose of the show was to collect women artists from around the state to celebrate Montana's centennial. At the onset of the project, she thought it would be difficult to find enough women artists to fill the survey. But as she said in her curator statement, after several phone calls, I found myself inundated with lists of names and consequently the task of selecting. This show, while revealing just how many women artists were working at the time, also exposed just how little they had been acknowledged. When the call went out, Deweese said she found a remarkable number of women who stayed in Montana and remained productive. But think about it. Deweese, by 1990, was well aware of most artists in the state. So how was it possible so many women stayed under the radar? Deweese self-identified as an artist who stood up for women. By curating a show strictly made up of women artists, she was able to bring these things to light. Through her paintings and through her role as the matriarch of Montana's artistic community, Deweese pulled back the curtain on women in the arts. Both Stockton and Deweese responded to place in vastly different but incredibly similar ways. Both believed in the distillation of elements so that the important aspect of their work began with the formal and ended in the sublime. Their work feels spontaneous but purposeful, with a graceful movement from season to season, from exterior to interior, from abstract to abstracted, through the use of nature and of pattern. They both felt the isolation of landscape. Even with Deweese's bustling family life, continual dropping by of friends and of colleagues, she wrote that while living in Montana, she often felt a kind of isolation that allows time for observation and reflection. Observation and seclusion seem to be a necessary ingredient in both Stockton's and Deweese's paintings. The quietude of life in a looming landscape opened up pathways to discover a new kind of language they needed to talk about their own interpretations of what place meant to them. Edward Casey states that place is an event that happens between the body and the landscape. It is near and far. Unlike time, place is open-ended. Think of a person in a canoe. The person is paddling in the canoe, but is also ahead of herself, approaching a destination. So that place becomes an extension of where she is and where she is going. For both Stockton and Deweese, their sense of place, as told all these years later, continue to tell us about where they were, where they came from, but they also foretell where they were going. They created a visual history, a map, of where their lives touched the ground and the connection between landscape and art, between place and aesthetics, toward faraway places and places just beyond their front doors. They point us toward the horizon and show us how to look ahead. Jenny Deweese and Bill Stockton offered up a new language that spoke to time, place, and the ability to translate what they saw into an expression of the world, their world. They did not paint replicas of majestic mountains. They painted what they saw exactly as they saw it. They brought their formal training to a place unfamiliar with modern art. And working on the vanguard of Montana's art scene, expanded the vocabulary of the day. In so doing, they influenced generations of artists to come. Their shared perspective on where they lived and how they lived defined their art. It was a language that invited the viewer to understand place in the same intimate way in which they lived it. Bill Stockton and Jenny Deweese offered up something fertile, complex, and expandable, helping us to understand their place, and in some way allowed us to make it our own. Thank you for coming along with me on this journey, and I'll just leave you with one Bill Stockton quote. Everything changes except the avant-garde.